This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Okay, we're going to be diving way deep into wild pigs. And we get tons of questions about wild pigs. And I'm going to give like sort of the ends of the, you know, I'm going to give two ends in the middle on sort of the sorts of questions we get about wild pigs. A question about wild pigs might be where someone would write in and send a link to an article. And it would be how somewhere wild pigs have turned up and they're wreaking ecological havoc. And what does one make of that? That'd be like a type of thing people always want to know about wild pigs. A lot of people might be like, hey, what's up? Are wild pigs good to eat? Can you get sick from them or what? That's the middle part that people want to hear about wild pigs. And another common question we get about wild pigs would be, if wild pigs are so bad and they're everywhere and they're going to kill everyone and destroy the whole universe and everyone's overrun with wild pigs, how come no one will let me go hunt wild pigs on their property? Like, wouldn't you think that if pigs are that bad, it wouldn't be so bad to have a stranger on your land hunting? But it seems that they're not quite that bad. So that's another question. And who's going to walk us through all of this? Not Giannis.
Not me.
It will be, in part, the portions that he's comfortable with would be our guest, Parker Hall. Now, Parker Hall, two things, and you can do it however. Three things, you can do whatever order you want. What do you do at work? Who do you work for? And then I would like to get a little bit into how did that happen.
Okay. What do I do at work? I'm a professional email doer and meeting goer tour.
Oh, really? Get out of here. We're going to go get a new. I know a whole mess of those people.
I work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, APHIS Wildlife Services. So our mission is to provide federal leadership with human-wildlife conflict. So that can range from feral swine or wild pigs. I have to call them feral swine.
That's what they tell you to
call
them?
Yeah, that's what they call them. That's what they told me. Wild pigs, feral swine, hogs, whatever. It can range from that to protecting airports from collisions with birds, to beaver control in the deep south, flooding roads and bridges, to coyote and predator control in the west. So it really depends on where you are in the country as to what that the different states do. So Wildlife Services is non-regulatory. That means we don't make any rules, which is kind of a good position to be in. So anywhere we are, we're there by invitation. We're oftentimes invited to help whatever land management agency, be it a state agency, another federal agency on invasive species, and feral swine's one that we deal with all over the country. So 2014, there was an initiative, an APHIS initiative, that provided some funding, set up a national program, said, all right, there's enough damage being going on with feral swine. We're getting enough people that are having some trouble with them, be it the ag industry, being it landowners, be it the natural resources people, that we need to do something about it. So that's kind of how this program got set up. So now that's two, right? What's the third one? How I got here?
How you got here just as a person to be here, but I'm already, can we put that on hold for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, because I already got a problem.
All right.
Okay, wild pigs were introduced here in the
1500s
by the Spanish.
Right. So they took off across the ocean, needed something to eat, right?
Okay.
Guys, we're going out. We don't know where we're going across the ocean. It's far. We better bring something to eat. So they float. They hit some land. They go, oh, man, that was good. We're still alive. Hey, we're still going. We don't know where we are. Let's put some pigs on, because when we come back, we're going to be hungry again. And so those repetitive introductions from those explorers all through the south and the islands, going all the way down through, you know, down to the South America and the Lesser Antilles and the Caribbean, all through there, you know, those repetitive introductions finally took hold. Native Americans figured out that, hey, this is better than eating some of the stuff we're eating right now. So they fostered that, and those pigs grew, and they kept them around, and they established populations. So since the 1500s, they've been all up and down.
So what happened during those hundreds of years when it didn't? Like, there was a shift, right? Because we had hundreds of years of it just being that there's some, that there's wild pigs around, there's wild pigs around. Then all of a sudden, in my lifetime.
Yeah, in mine.
It's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Wild pigs.
Yeah.
Like what was that?
So,
is it perception or is it reality?
It's reality. So if you look at a natural expansion of any population, be it wild pigs or anything, it's kind of like a balloon blowing up, right? You blow in the balloon, it gets bigger, 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 and the population spreads. Well, that's not been the case with feral pigs. I mean, you guys are from Michigan, right? There's feral pigs in Michigan. They didn't get there from Florida by chance. They got there in the back of a pickup truck.
Yeah.
So it became, you know, I grew up in Georgia hunting hogs. It was fun. It's a cultural thing in the Deep South. A lot of people do it. And, you know, but it's been maintained, particularly in the Deep South, Texas, California.
Did your father hunt wild pigs?
Oh, yeah. My whole family. And they still do.
Okay.
Of course they do. but I think it got cool, or whatever, for lack of a better term, cool, to hunt pigs by television shows. It got put on TV, and people think that killing a 200-pound hog is awesome. There are very few laws regulating hogs. You know, it differs by state, but they're all a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to catch pigs. As one of my good friends says, it takes very, very little energy to put pigs in the back of a truck and move them. But it takes tremendous energy to get them back from the wild and put them back into that pickup truck.
Yeah.
And that's a fact. So
I think there's probably a lot of ways for people to begin to understand that. Even if you're not familiar with wild pigs, would be just the you know, what we often call bucket biology with fisheries, where you can trace back to sort of like a single introductory effort of a fish species into some lake and river system, and then pretty soon it becomes literally impossible to undo, like literally impossible to undo the damage.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with the pigs, I remember, well, you know, but you're assigned to a specific, like, does your expertise extend beyond where you're?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we do a lot of different things in the state, in the two states.
Because what I wanted to ask about is, I remember in Michigan, it wasn't that long ago, Michigan was putting up some, trying to create some legislation around, obviously you can't block people from transporting pigs because it's all the same species, right? Sus scrofa.
Right, correct.
Is the same thing you buy in a grocery store. It's all the same species. But so, they were trying to put some language around what types of pigs could be moved into the state.
Right.
Can you explain that a little bit? When you talk about that people are moving pigs, right? They're not moving barnyard varieties of pigs, or are they?
Well, they're doing all of the above. Like you mentioned, it's all the same species. They can all interbreed. So Spanish pigs, like we talked about before, are the ones that were introduced in the 1500s in the South. There's been introductions from the Eurasian wild boar, the big hairy woolly ones that everybody thinks about, you know, that came over from Europe, and those were introduced into New Hampshire, Vermont area, and some in California, moved around. People liked them for sport.
I know the New Hampshire, Vermont ones were brought in for hunting purposes.
Yeah, right, right.
But it's just hard to contain them.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to contain them, and you know, there's been sales. Hey, you have some of those? You know, a guy comes in and goes, "What's it cost?" You know, sell me some of those. Well, nobody cares. He loads them up. Here's $100 or whatever it is, and moves them to Idaho and turns them loose. You know, they're incredibly hardy. They're incredibly fecund. You know, 115 days or so, they have a litter. Go a few weeks. get pregnant again, you know, they can have a couple litters a year. So they're super hardy, you know. They're the ultimate invasive species.
Compare that to a deer who puts off between, you know, one and two a
year. Yeah, one or two, yeah.
Now, I want to get back into the long-term story, but first I want to ask if this is true. People like to say, they like to put this timeline around, if you take a domestic, like a domesticated domestic variety pig, and you turn it out, that the minute you turn it out, all of a sudden it grows big, gigantic tusks and gets a woolly coat.
Yeah, no, that's not, it depends on the species. Oh, not the species, but the, I don't know if it's a subspecies or whatever, you know, a pink pig that's grown for in a pig parlor is a little different than, you know, some of these heritage pigs or whatever. So there's a bunch of different flavors, if you will, but, if turned loose over time, they do revert back pretty quick. It's not overnight. A lot of times when hogs get loose, we'll get reports. There's some feral swine over there, and they get hungry and go back to the feed bucket in 2 days.
Okay.
All of those in between, you know, sometimes they go off, and if they have a litter, then those pigs are generally pretty wary. They're dealing with predators.
That first wild born generation.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you take a feral hog and put him in the pen, and it doesn't take long for them to tame right down.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a couple of weeks, you start shaking the food bucket, you know, it starts approaching a little bit, and over time, they'll tame right down as well.
So you can re-domesticate them.
You can.
Yeah. All right, now I'm ready to go back and do what we were going to do a minute ago, and you kind of alluded to it now. So you grew up hunting pigs.
I did. Yeah, I grew up hunting and fishing. My dad was a USDA APHIS Wildlife Services employee for his career.
Too. Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So,
you grew up. That's how I was kind of wondering. So you grew up kind of knowing that this is a thing a person could do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I did. But I didn't have the aspirations to be a state director. I remember thinking as I was going through school, I graduated from the University of Georgia barely. I think I had a stellar 2.2 or 3.
Studying what?
Mostly hog hunting at night and crappie fishing. But I did get a degree in wildlife. So I remember thinking, if I can ever make about $35,000 or $40,000 a year trapping beavers, I will have reached the pinnacle.
Uh-huh.
So I started off as a beaver trapper in Alabama, and I went through several years of that, and I did some
just doing private nuisance control.
No, I was working as a specialist for USDA.
Okay,
yeah, so it was entry level, and that went on for several years, and I got into doing some invasive species work when I was down in the U.S. Virgin Islands doing work down there. Met my wife down there, and
how were you catching the beavers?
And when I was in Alabama, were
you doing like
conibear, bear, snare, foothold?
So the whole gamut,
the whole thing. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I know.
Not those Hancock live traps. You guys were getting after them for real.
Yeah, that's dudes from Michigan use those.
Yeah, never touched one.
So yeah, did some work in the islands, and then went to Florida. Did
what kind of work in the islands?
Offshore eradication kind of stuff. And you know, we did rat eradications, goat eradications to protect threatened and endangered species.
Small islands?
On small offshore islands. It's really neat, actually, when you remove a species like a rat or a goat, what the island does, you know, the smaller islands. Man, they bloom like a flower, you know,
really?
right back, you know, when you remove those invasives. So,
did you ever use the Judas strategy?
Yes, and I still do.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, so if you remember your Bible stories, Judas was the one who betrayed Jesus, and so that's where the term Judas animal comes from. So you take that animal capture, so in feral swine, we'll take one and put a radio transmitter on its neck or in its ear, capture it, turn it back loose, and it'll run back to the other, you know, sounders, which you call a group of hogs. It'll go back to a sounder or, you know, other pigs, and it'll lead you to those. So it's real effective. It's really, really effective, particularly in low densities.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like where we are right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It does good. Yeah. We use it a lot.
So you studied up on wildlife, went into doing beaver work, and then your career kind of took off.
It did.
And then one day, someone springs on you that your jurisdiction is going to be
I was a district supervisor in South Florida and do invasive species. I really enjoyed
it. Did you work on the Burmese python?
Yeah, we did work on the Burmese python a little bit. Yeah.
And you hit all the big news story animals.
Yeah. They're they're difficult. That's a difficult problem, the snakes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do you think that there will ever be a solution? Or is it just too hard to predict?
You know, they sent a man to the moon, so I don't know, but the thing about the invasive reptiles is, let's face it, they're not going to go past the freeze line for the most part. So, you know, they're confined to those habitats and those areas that are akin to how they evolved.
Gotcha.
You know, so
we won't someday be talking about Burmese pythons in Michigan like we're talking about
wild pigs in Michigan. I don't think so. Until wintertime. I've been to Michigan in the wintertime, and pythons won't do too well.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So South Florida, and and you probably worked on pigs in South Florida.
I did. We did a lot of pig work in Florida.
Iguanas?
Did iguanas. Yeah, sure did. In Florida, we did some more rat eradications, actually, to protect nesting shore birds. Predator control on beaches for sea turtles was a big one.
What's something that gets after sea turtle eggs?
Man, everything likes an egg, right? Raccoons are bad. Feral swine are terrible on them.
There's places where feral swine are out on the beach. Saltwater beach.
There are guys who their job is to stay on the beach all night long to make sure feral swine don't come out there and dig up sea turtle nests.
And they're seeing some.
Oh man, they're doing effective control and they're saving thousands and thousands and thousands of sea turtles. One nest is wrecked by a hog.
We've been on beaches down in South America. We've been on beaches where all the turtle eggs have been dug up by jaguars.
Yeah. Everything likes a turtle egg.
Yeah.
Ghost crabs, raccoons, armadillos, possums, foxes.
So you guys would select a beach and just be like, hands off.
Now remember we're non-regulatory. So we're there by the invitation of whatever entity is responsible for that beach.
So Florida's making that call.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
Whatever entity has jurisdiction over that beach asks us to do that work.
I understand.
Yeah.
So it's always coming from it's a local ask, and you guys provide the expertise to execute what they're hoping to accomplish.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from South Florida, then what happens to you?
So from South Florida, a position came open as a state director in New Hampshire and Vermont. Now, like I said, I grew up in Georgia. I'd never been north of Tennessee, hardly. I was in South Florida, and that position came open, and I talked to my wife about it. I said, hey, there's an opportunity, you know. So we said, yeah, that'll be fine.
What state was she from?
She's from Missouri, and I'll get to that in a minute. You can deduce. Mm-hmm. But went up to got selected for that position and had a wonderful experience in New Hampshire, Vermont, working on all sorts of different critters.
Like what up there?
A lot of black bear stuff was going up there.
Oh, not non-natives.
Right. A lot of natives there. Yeah. Did some moose work. You know, for a Georgia boy, it was a really neat experience. And then the
And the black bears are getting trouble with orchards.
The whole thing.
Honey production.
Right. Down in the, you know, it's a big tourist economy in the summertime. It's gorgeous in New Hampshire and Vermont. And, the black bears down there following tourists around eating donuts and, you know, the whole thing.
So you guys do a lot of relocations there?
Yeah,
I'm guessing?
Yeah, a lot of relocations there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else? Did you get involved with any fish anywhere?
No. Nope, not a fish guy.
There's
other people, than I like to
are there
fish.
Wildlife services people who mess with fish?
There are wildlife services people that, yes, that do invasive fish work. I think there's one state out west that does. I'm not quite sure, but as a general rule, we don't do. That's left to the fisheries biologists. Fish are a whole different thing, you know, under the water, and those guys can do math good.
Yeah. The fisheries guys?
Yeah.
What was the common moose conflict?
The common moose conflict was the moose walking through where they make the maple syrup, and those guys have great big taps, right? When these tubes coming way down to their tap house. Sometimes they'd have thousands of these tubes coming on, and the moose just walk right through it, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And they're like, you know, it's the middle of saps running, and those guys are freaking out, man. All their taps just got, yanked off. So, it was interesting, particularly for me, doesn't know anything about moose, you know, so it was an educational experience.
Yeah, right? I can imagine.
Yeah, it was a good time.
So then from there?
From there, the Missouri State Director, Missouri-Iowa State Director position came available, and my wife said, guess what, big boy? I like the Royals. So, yeah, I put in for that position, and, I think it was a good move for me in as much that I was not from the Northeast, but it was a great experience, but to get to something I was a little bit more familiar with.
But a little more familiar.
Sure, sure.
And so you, as a state coordinator or state director?
State director.
State director. Everything, again, here, everything falls under your purview, so to speak. But you guys are particularly focused or paying a lot of attention on wild pigs, or is that just a small part of the...
It's more than a small part in Missouri. So we have what's called the Missouri Feral Swine Partnership, and that is 11 different land management agencies who are committed to suppressing or eliminating feral swine from the state of Missouri. So it's a pretty good chunk of our program. Iowa does a lot of work at dairy farms for starlings and invasive like those starlings, pigeons, sparrows, those things, milk and the whole deal, airport stuff. If a deer runs out on the airport and at 3 a.m. and a plane's trying to land, we have people there to help assist remove that. A lot of airport work in Missouri. Avian influenza, so a disease component of our program, sampling for different diseases, which goes hand in hand with the feral swine stuff.
Okay.
Sampling there, so a little bit of everything. Now, the Missouri Department of Conservation has pretty much driven this program, so we're doing feral swine work by their invitation and their direction.
Now, you mentioned suppression or eradication. Doesn't that cause a little mission confusion? Can't you just pick one?
Yeah, well, we use the word elimination.
Yeah. So there's no mission confusion.
No, there's no mission confusion. Yeah.
Lay the wild pig situation. Like, give me a little bit of history on the wild pig situation here
in Missouri.
Yeah, because it's different than Florida, right? Because in Florida, they've been underground for centuries.
Right, right.
Is it too early? Timing might be off, but I'd like to definitely know at some point if it's legal to hunt pigs in this state, in Iowa.
Sure.
Timing's off, but you can ask.
Should have waited.
So
you weren't detecting the flow I was going? It's not been very clearly defined, has it?
It was good.
My flow?
Yeah.
It's a little herky jerky. I don't see why we can't get into that right now. It's not gonna hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's completely legal to hunt feral swine in Missouri. Where it is illegal to hunt feral swine is on Missouri Department of Conservation lands. It's illegal on Fort Leonard Wood. It's illegal on Army Corps of Engineers land. But on private land, right now in the Mark Twain National Forest, it's legal to hunt feral swine.
What is the obvious question comes up? Why? If you want to get rid of them.
Yeah. So let's go back to the first part of when we started talking.
Like what's the lay of the land here?
In Georgia, when I grew up, there's no season. There's no limit. There's really no restriction on how you can hunt them with what you can use. You can use guns, bows, bazookas, whatever, and has been that way. And they only grow. So hunting does not work to eliminate. We use hunting as a tool to manage our native species, not eliminate our native. That's why we have limits, and particularly if you can or can't shoot female of any animal, because that the result of removal of those is population control, and so that's something that Missouri Department of Conservation said, look, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. I mean, there's guys all over the South that's chased them for millennia, and it's the stronghold of feral swine. Yeah. They're there.
Like recreational hunting, because of the fecundity and all these other factors,
sure.
Recreational hunting, even when it's unrestricted, doesn't do it.
Right. Right. So, a recreational hunter goes out and he has a good time and he harvests a hog and he comes back and they clean it up and they have a meal, but it did absolutely nothing for the population. It's fun. It's great. It's good recreation, but it's an exotic invasive species that should be removed. They're competing with our natives.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the thinking, so extend that out and explain the thinking on restricting hunting.
Well, I don't know that it's a. I mean, it doesn't work. It's been proven that hunting does not eliminate a species of any species. Recreational sport hunting doesn't. I don't know that.
Yeah, go ahead, man. Brandon Butler wants to butt in.
Yeah.
Another big issue is creating the demand. So if there's a demand for feral hogs, then there's going to be a desired supply. And by eliminating the opportunity to hunt them, you're hopefully eliminating that
incentive.
Right. So if the Department of Conservation, even though they're setting these traps up, that's another problem. They're setting up these traps, putting a lot of man hours into it. Parker and his team's doing the same thing. They work really hard to train these sounders to come to these traps so they can catch a mass of these pigs at one time. People will find those traps and they'll set up on them like hunting spots. And when the sounder comes in, they'll shoot one or maybe two, and then they scatter the rest. And they'll run way off and they'll set up new ranges.
And you blow the plan.
So you blow the whole plan. You waste all that money that's been spent not only on the staff that's out working, but on the corn they're souring and all the other bait, the materials it takes to make the traps. But as you said, hog hunting's fun. And a lot of people down in this part of the country, I mean, they have dogs. They're really into it. So they're expecting there to be a supply of hogs on the landscape.
Well, I'll throw this in from – I mean, this is like this aspect of it is something I'm familiar with. And Giannis and I have had discussions with an individual who was a hog trapper and at a time in the past had even gone so far as to sell wild hogs to people who he later learned were using the wild hogs to establish populations of wild hogs in areas that did not have them in order to be able to hunt for them.
That's going on down here. There's
it goes on all over the country.
Yeah, there's
that's how they are spread.
Is anybody ever getting prosecuted for this?
Yeah, there's a case going on in the county north of us right now.
Okay,
where somebody is a known violator who
propagator.
Who actually raises these hogs and then releases them, trailers them in from other states, keeps them in a pen. When people are ready to go hunting, those people will pay this guy. He'll release those hogs, and they'll go chase them down
on open lands, not penned lands.
On open lands, yeah. So he'll keep them in a pen until he has clients. Once he has clients willing to pay, they'll release those hounds, or they'll release those hogs, and they'll release the hounds. The hounds will chase them down. The one dog goes out and finds them. The rest of the dogs come in and hold them. That person goes in and likely stabs the hog or may shoot it, but a lot of them are killing them with big Bowie knives and
we've
chasing them down that way. So they're not only creating a demand for the recreation of it, but there's a small group of people that are creating an industry around it. And you're talking about doing so in a very economically depressed part of the country. So when these guys can get cash on hand for letting you go out and kill some hogs,
why wouldn't you? Yeah,
it's hard to convince them that that's not a good deal.
Brandon, do you mind real quick laying out your affiliations?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of the Conservation Federation of Missouri. We work with hunting, angling, all conservation wildlife groups across the state. I've known Parker for a few years. There was a feral hog symposium where state wildlife leaders came from kind of all over the Midwest. And we did a tour of a state park, and then we went on some private property. And that was the first time I was ever really exposed to the real destruction that these hogs do to ag lands.
and why there's so much money being spent to eradicate them, because so much money is being lost by farmers down here as their pastures are destroyed and crop fields can be decimated. It was really eye-opening to me, and I've kind of been studying it with Parker ever since.
Now, Parker, when you look at the voices that most want to, so I kind of understand the voices that are interested in having pigs is like isolated groups of people who want to have some hunting opportunity. What are the voices of the people here that sort of have the best argument against the pigs being here?
Well, I understand those people too, because like I said, I grew up doing it and it's fun. And, you know, right or wrong, they've incentivized it.
Incentivized.
2.2.
Chase or Chase Lounge earlier. Right. So, I understand that. And, but we're land managers, right? Or we're stewards of the land. It's an exotic invasive species. It's no different than bush honeysuckle. It shouldn't be here. It competes with our natives. I think it's difficult for us wildlife people to go, it's competing with our natives, and there's still deer and turkeys around. And,
yeah.
That's
the thing I think people have a hard time with, because
they do.
They'll look and be like, okay, but Texas is known for its whitetail hunting. Texas has wild pigs.
That's right. Texas has the most wild pigs. But, you know, you look at the things that deer and turkey aren't the only things on the landscape. Agricultural damage, threatened and endangered species, water quality, you know, all of these things are being caused from an exotic invasive species that shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're wildlife biologists. In some instances, you just want to be like, geez, that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, we're supposed to protect our native species. And it's just not fauna, it's flora as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know in Hawaii, they talk about an unknown quantity, but perhaps dozens of species of wildlife were lost with the introduction of pigs and rats.
Yeah.
Onto the Hawaiian Islands.
Sure.
Because they had a whole suite of, you know, because of a lack of certain types of predation, they had whole suites of ground nesting birds.
Right.
That vanished.
Yeah, gone. You look at the disease issues too, with the domestic industry we have here. You know, the potential for a disease to get in the domestic industry could be catastrophic to the state. You know, we're one state south of the biggest pork producing state in the country, which is Iowa.
Okay.
So
there's a fear there that wild pigs would.
Sure, they have those diseases. They carry those diseases that the ag industry has done such a wonderful job of getting rid of, and it's taken them a long time. And now they're out. You know, they've got those domestic populations, for lack of a better word, clean. And reintroducing some of those diseases could be a real setback financially, for consumers as well as producers.
What's funny there, and I don't expect you to comment on this unless you want to, but what's funny there is to have this idea of, I know you call it feral swine, but like in common vernacular, where you have this idea of a wild pig introducing disease to a domestic counterpart. Is sort of the opposite of the fear around domestic deer introducing disease to their wild counterpart.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, it is.
That's off topic.
Yeah.
Well, we've kind of breezed over like the problems, you know, that the pigs do and how and why, but can we just get into that a little bit more? Like you talk, like you're like water quality, but what exactly do they do to diminish water quality, and what are they doing to, you know, kill all these crops for all these farmers? Exactly.
Well, one of the creeks that we were hunting around down here, it looked better this year. Steve and I walked past it, but last year, this real lush little spring creek. And the spring was really pumping yesterday when we were down there. It was just absolutely decimated with rooting. I mean, you go down there and you're expecting to be in this real serene, natural valley, and it looked like a monster truck had been ripping up and down this spring creek. Now, this is way back in a wilderness, so very few people are laying their eyes on that. But if that was your private property, that would be infuriating to you. So you would call the government or whoever your representative is and say, something has to be done about this invasive species that's destroying, you know, my landscape. That would be...
They're just in there feeding and just rooting it all up, and it just turns into a mud
and wallowing.
They're just wallowing and rooting, and now all that mud and sediment is running into that stream, which runs into a larger stream, which runs into a river. So it's sending all that sediment downriver. The crop damage is just hard to explain. It's unbelievable. It looks like somebody went in with a brush hog.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. They can do a lot of damage in a very short amount of time. And that's something that is more common maybe in the South than it is in Missouri. Missouri is more... they're more in the Ozarks. We do have some damage, and the guys that have it don't take it lightly. But, you know, we have... state and federal listed species that are stored. Hinds emerald dragonfly, they have a they lay their larva in a specialized little I forget the name of it. I don't know, it's an eco term, you know, but the hogs go through and root up and eat the larva and they don't reproduce. Mead's milkweed is another species of concern, listed species that hogs go through and trample and eat and destroy and they don't come back. So, you know, you look at it's not just we still have deer and we still have turkeys and, you know, they ate some of my corn, but we're talking about, you know, threatened and endangered species. It's, you know, there's only very few of these left in the world. They're being consumed or destroyed by an exotic invasive that shouldn't be here. You know, I don't know if if a Hinds emerald dragonfly were flying around this room, I don't know if I could identify it, but I know that, you know, it's a species that once they're gone, they're gone. Happening because of these feral swine. And that's an example I use. It's, you know, whether it's sea turtles or shorebirds or whatever, you know, we have an exotic doing damage and removing federally and state listed species.
So how many feral pigs? Well, let's take it this way. How far back in time would you need to go to when there were probably no feral pigs in this state?
In Missouri? So I wasn't here then, but they're relatively new. Yeah, if you went back 15 years, I don't know that you could find too many people. You guys might know this better than me, but you couldn't find too many people that knew where a feral hog was. You go back 20 years, they're very, very rare. You know, they were brought in, and just like I said, they're incredibly cocooned, and you guys see the terrain we're in, man. You turn some pigs back here, they go undetected for forever.
Gotcha. So this is a fairly new issue here.
Oh, absolutely.
And how many, is there an estimate on how many there are?
No. We're doing some work on that now, but there is not an estimate. Mm-mm.
Well, how about you put it this way? How many of you guys caught and killed?
So the last year, we caught and killed just over 6,500.
In this state?
In the state. Yeah, just in Missouri. But now, other states take, numbers, many, many, many more than that. Texas, Oklahoma, you know, those guys, they take a lot of pigs, multiple thousands of hogs.
And in that time, when you've taken them, have you guys gotten a sense of where exactly they're coming from?
Well, we know where they are. And as much as it's a relatively new, you say 15 years, it's a relatively new problem. The Missouri Department of Conservation has really rolled up its sleeves and got to work and asked their biologists and their people in the field and done a lot of work. And we know, or we feel like we have a pretty good handle on where those populations are. And it looks like it's not a blob, of course, like natural. It looks like a zebra or a checkerboard or it's patchwork. And so
across the entire state,
mostly in the southern half and mostly in the Ozarks and mostly on public land.
Really?
Yeah, of course. Why do you think that is?
I have no idea why.
Because people can hunt it.
Really?
And so if you were to turn, if you had a truckload of pigs and your neighbor is a guy you don't get along with, you know he's not going to let you hunt those pigs in the back of your truck on his place. You're going to turn them loose on his place?
Yeah.
Of course not. You're going to go where...
I say, yeah, I mean, no.
Yeah, right. You're going to go where you can hunt them. So if you lay the map of where feral swine are in Missouri over public ground, it almost marries up perfectly.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I thought it was real interesting when I was showing Parker yesterday pictures of the feral hogs I got on my property. He's like, well, that's a Springfield hog. And, I mean, they've got it drilled down.
Yeah, well,
your
property is, like, up against a large chunk of public property.
One of the largest contiguous pieces of public property in Missouri.
Yeah.
So they're definitely getting released back in there. But he's able to tell you, like, distinctly where this hog has been shipped in from and where this hog has been shipped in.
Well, I know they look a little different in different parts of the state, and so... Yeah, I don't know that I would go as far as to know. I know exactly where they're from, but yeah, but they are. They differ depending on where you grab them from you know, different parts of the state. In different parts of the country, they look completely different. So, you know, it's...
they're not homogenized, meaning there's like different ones that have different backgrounds.
Sure.
People got them from different places and cut them loose.
Sure. And something that people do a lot of times is they introduce domestics into those wild or feral populations to increase the size, body size.
Okay.
You know, so for hunting purposes.
How Hogzilla came around.
Well, some of those, I remember one of those giant pigs that turns up, like a Hogzilla, I don't know if like the, it was like not the original one, but one of these giant pigs that turns up where a guy supposedly killed some stomp or wild pig. A few days later, a guy comes out with photographs of this thing standing in the back of the truck because he sold it to the guy.
Of course, yeah.
He's like, that's not a wild pig. That's old Stella.
Yeah.
And provides photo documentation on it.
If you get 250, 300 pounds, that's a serious wild hog. That's a big one, you know.
And wild hog.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not eating corn from the bucket, you know. They're eating acorns and whatever else they can get down in out in the woods. So, you know, 250, 300 pounds is a great big one. Now, they get bigger, but, you know, that's a great big adult.
So I want to get into talking about the process of how it all works, meaning you identify here's a new blip on the map, okay? You identify a population of these things.
Right.
How does it come to your attention, okay? How do you verify the presence? And then what are the steps that take as you sort of walk through, like, wow, now we got a new gang of pigs we got to deal with?
All right, that's kind of a two-part question. Number one, how do we deal with the new populations? What do we do? So, like I said, the Missouri Department of Conservation, Mark Twain National Forest, Army Corps of Engineers, we have a group of 11 land management agencies that are all out on these public lands. Now, public lands and private lands, we differentiate. We do not go on anybody's land that does not invite us. So farmers or people who have feral swine or wild hogs, they want help, they give us a shout, right? So
you can't go on someone's land the same way you'd be able to go onto their land for, you know, emergency purposes or anything like
that? No way.
Really?
No. We can't trespass. We have a form that we have to get them to sign that lets us be on their property.
Yeah, I mean, that's good, obviously. It's not surprising me. But I mean, I know that there are certain things, like if you're cooking up some meth on your land, for instance, people can go on there and get that.
Wildlife Services can't because we're non-regulatory. Yeah. So...
That's got to at times. I know that you don't set the policy, but that at times has to be really problematic.
It always will be. So if you're trying to do an eradication, there's three things that have to happen, right? You have to have a control that works, right? You have to have something that gets rid of whatever you're trying to get rid of. If you're doing rats, you have to have a toxicant that kills them, right? And it has to be effective. Number two, every individual has to be exposed to said control measure, right? And number three, you have to have 100%. Number two, everybody's got to get exposed, which is the problem. And number three, you can't have any immigration in from outside sources. So if we get rid of all the pigs in southern Missouri and somebody brings them back in, well, by God, we start over. So yeah. those three things have
That's
to happen.
That's why it seems like eradication can happen on small islands
right.
successfully, right. but it doesn't happen on large land masses.
It happens on large land masses when everybody gets united and recognizes these are bad. But you were right, and it's a fact. It's going to be very problematic in the future.
Yeah, there's a fight going on right now legislatively over feral hogs. You actually have legislators down in this part of the state in support of feral hog hunting, very upset with the Department of Conservation for trying to do the right thing and eliminate not only the desire to hunt them, but the entire population. So it's a political battle.
So there's an actual political conversation about whether or not you want wild pigs or not?
The only reason you can hunt wild pigs on the Mark Twain National Forest right now is because a certain politician has threatened, you know, retribution if it were to be stopped.
Gotcha. All right, so back to how does a problem become, like, how does a new population become identified? And then what steps are taken to go address the issue?
All right. So we have a strategic elimination plan within Missouri, within our patchwork. We know where they are. We know the terrain, the habitat, the accessibility, and then we put those resources in that area. Elimination area zone one is our lowest population. We have the most accessibility to it. The terrain is most conducive for elimination, and we're being very, very successful. We are repetitively successful on, if you think about a fire and a little ember goes out in your yard and starts that, those are popping up, and that's what you're talking about. When those pop up, we drop what we're doing, and we make sure those populations do not become established.
Okay.
So we have, like I said, 11 partner agencies, and all their people are out there all the time on all these public lands. And when new sign or sightings happen, it gets to us pretty quick. And we've been very successful at suppressing those new populations.
Like, you'll look and there's a new blip on the map that takes priority over some established population that you've been struggling against.
It does, yeah.
And what will you guys do? Like, how do you go in and even begin?
Well, it's once we get land access, it's no different than any other the control worker do. We set up cameras, look at the sign, put out bait, get them on bait, and trap them and remove them as quick as we can.
So you use trail cameras to try to verify the presence?
Yeah, we use trail cameras. And, you know, the thing about pigs is you kind of know when they're there. You know, they
really
make such a mess. And, you know, they're rooting in tracks and rubbing on trees. It's not hard to figure out when they're there. And, you know, something we use trail cameras for.
Do you ever identify a population of, like, one?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you can come in, someone could be like, hey, I saw a wild pig. And you can go in and usually you're like a good enough tracker or whatever that someone could go in there and be like, yeah, it's true.
There's no, I'm not that good. There, it's a pig. You dump out corn and they come to it.
That's how you verify them.
Sure.
Yeah. Or that's a way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then what are the ways in which you guys catch them and kill them?
We do mostly, probably 90% of our take is trapping. A smaller percent is night shooting, and then another percent is aerial gunning.
So talk about the night shooting. How's that work?
Night shooting is used in specific situations. A lot of times when we have single boars, we don't spend a lot of time trapping boars. We target females because that's our population control, the sounders, the big groups. So we're targeting them. If we have some boars that are hanging around, sometimes we'll do that. If we're having crop damage, so if you have a field of corn, right? If you have 100 acres of corn, it's hard to go pour out a bucket of corn and get them to come in your trap.
Yeah.
And every night, you know, that corn's in the dough stage and the hogs are wrecking it, you know, and the landowner, the farmer's just beside himself pulling his hair out. We use a lot of night shooting then to keep them out of the corn. When we get down to the last few animals, that is generally how we remove them, through night shooting.
So I was able to go out on one of these night shooting excursions with some of Parker's people, and not to diminish the noble work, but man, that was pretty fun. Like, we actually were in the bed of a pickup truck, and I was the guy with a thermal imaging scope, and we're cruising the cornfields on the outside of Fort Leonard Wood Army Base, and you're just on farms that you have permission to be on, driving their farms in the winter using thermal imaging to locate these hogs. And the driver's driving, we're sitting in the back scoping. When you see them, you tap on the top of the truck, they stop, the shooter gets out, pow, pow, pow,
just like, starts taking them out. How many might you run into?
One field had 30 in it, probably. That was the biggest one we saw. And then once in a while.
This is working to assist a farmer who's trying to protect a crop.
Yeah. And as a general rule, we on those big groups, we really try not to night shoot them. We try not to shoot where we're trapping, because it really messes up our whole system, makes them much more difficult to trap. These situations are, like we said, when a farmer's just beside himself and you know, he's just getting so much damage that's really one of our only options. Is to do night work like that.
Okay, so talk about trapping.
So,
sort of like the how of it, right?
Right. So, like I said, there's a process, and it varies how successful we are by time of year, by location, a lot of variables. It can be very frustrating or very, very efficient. We had a guy last year that works with us, Jason. He caught 62 pigs in one trap, and then I think he had over 100 just that week. So when they're coming to your corn, where they're not being pressured from outside sources, where they're not being run with dogs, people shooting at them, they're pigs. They're pretty easy to catch.
And how long do you got to train them up on the corn?
With the system that we're using right now, whenever they get on the corn, we set the trap in a matter of 2 or 3 nights. We generally have.
Oh, so you're not like pre-baiting them for weeks to get them.
Sometimes
used to it.
We do, and it depends on the type of trap, and it depends on the time of year. So you know, it varies. It's a wild animal. You know, it doesn't read the same books that we do. So
yeah.
You know, you could get them all the first night, or it could take a month.
Oh, so you're kind of going by how many you know to be in the area and how many you figure are hitting the bait,
right?
And
in the thought,
how regularly they're hitting the bait,
right? We use cameras a lot for that. So what we want to do is catch. You know, we're working for elimination, so we don't want to catch the first 2 pigs that run in the trap. You know, we want to catch the 28 others that are outside. So we take steps to make sure that we get all of those animals in there, to remove the whole group. You know, one or two animals doesn't do us any good. It educates the other ones. That, you know, it's a lot of investment for a very little return.
So describe the trap and how it sort of relates to the bait pile.
Well, I'm going to get in trouble for this, because each trapper is very specific about how he likes it, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
But the long and short of it is we use a round corral trap.
Okay.
With a drop door in the front. We use a round corral trap that's elevated off the ground.
Well, the whole corral is elevated.
The whole corral, yeah.
And what's the diameter on that thing?
5 16-foot panels, 4 16-foot panels. So whatever the math works out of that is pretty big. You know, there's
a 16-by-16 corral.
Yeah, yeah. We use some commercially made ones.
And you're suspending it on what?
It's real hard to explain with us. There's a cardinal pole that goes in the middle, and some arms that go out, and a slide that goes up and down. It's kind of a reverse.
So it looks pulley, kind of like an umbrella.
Pulley, yeah, umbrella type mechanism.
And they'll walk in under the bar of the suspended trap.
It's really neat. You know, the Noble Foundation developed a trap called the Boar Buster, and we use it a lot. And it's really effective. And I don't know, but somebody needs to do a study. It's not that hogs don't look up, but if they can see through something, I think they go in a lot faster than they do like a regular door, 6-8 foot wide door. I don't know if they don't like going through it or what, but the thing, the guys that came up with that technology, man, they revolutionized hog trapping as far as getting hogs to go underneath. Started out years ago, I think, with the drop nets. You remember those?
Yeah.
Same concept. This is just a hog trap, and a metal hog trap that drops down. And so, you know, it just varies. You know, sometimes a regular door, they'll run right in. You just, it's variable.
So the drop trap, are they monitoring it through some kind of camera?
Right. So the commercial ones are monitored through some kind of camera. Ours are not, because as you can tell this week by your cell phone, they're absolutely useless. You might as well throw it in the river out here. No cell service whatsoever. So okay. Ours are triggered manually by a hog. And, you know, as interesting, we came up with all different sort of trigger mechanisms and different ways of doing it to try to maximize our catch. And one of the guys that worked with us now said, "Hey guys, let's put the trigger, the height of the biggest pig that we have on camera instead of right down on the ground."
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And, you know, we kind of looked at each other like, well, we haven't been doing that for 10 years, you know? So the first ones in, just like anything, you know, the young dumb ones run right in, you know, the smaller animals. And generally, the last animal to go in is the biggest, most mature. And so the goal is to have that animal inside. And generally, when that animal's inside, then all the rest of them are caught. Yeah.
So how many did someone get in one trap?
62, I think.
62 inside a 16 by 16 box.
They were packed in, yeah.
Did it get them all? Some had to score it.
I got every one of them. It was super neat.
And that was it.
And it might have been 68, but I think it was 62. Yeah. That was it. Gone. I mean, 62 pigs gone, you know, in 3 nights, one guy. What would it take to do that with dogs, with stand hunting, with sport hunting? I mean,
you're not going to get there.
You're not, never.
Yeah, I see what you're saying now. Explain the other kind of trap, the corral trap that's not suspended. Just got trap doors?
Sure, just trap doors. And there's all different styles, and they all work, you know, their own way. And, you know, some are very effective and some of them not so much. You know, there's a whole nother discussion on the trap door. Some guys are super, you know, it's trappers, man. They're all got their own thing. But they're all effective. You know, once you train that animal to go inside, they're effective. There's multi-catch doors, and then the ones you can trigger from your cell phone, or ones that are manually triggered, and, you know, all variations in through there.
When does aerial gunning come into play? Because that's got to be expensive.
Well, aerial gunning comes into play in Missouri. In other areas, they do a lot more of it, but the terrain's a lot better for it than in the Ozarks, you know. Aerial gunning comes into play when we're trying to protect a very remote area. You know, as you can imagine, getting some traps way back in some of these areas. We also use aerial gunning for the last few animals, particularly if trap shy ones or ones we can't find. We'll use that helicopter to do that. We did it most recently down in southeast Missouri when the water came up. And when the water comes up and the river floods and all the pigs get on the levee systems, you can be very, very effective.
So you pick
and choose. And we also use aerial gunning, not just aerial gunning, but aerial surveillance. So when you're thinking about elimination, you have to detect everybody. So we know we may have some pigs in this area. We're not sure. So you can go up and look down in the wintertime and see if there's fresh rooting or not. Like, hey, we flew this whole area and there's no fresh rooting. It would have taken us months to scout it out by ground, you know, or by foot. So it's used for other things other than just aerial control.
So where, like, take a place like where we're sitting right now.
Right.
There's pigs up there.
Yeah.
I think we took a picture of a track today. So where is it on the list, right? like where is this spot? How would you typify this location we are? We're in a big chunk of public land.
Right.
The Ozarks.
So we're in an elimination area.
It's pretty heavily roaded up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of recreation that goes on. It's bordered by small farms and recreational properties. And there's some number of wild pigs out there. So is this spot like on hold, or is it like on monitoring, or is it active control?
It's active control. Okay. So this is elimination area zone 4, I think. So elimination area zone 4 calls for X number of people. I'd have to look in the plan, but there's guys in this zone that are working this area nonstop. This is one of our areas where we take the most iron in Reynolds County.
So you have trappers that are working here now?
Oh yeah, yeah, all through this area, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're using all these different things that you've laid out.
Where we were talking about that creek, there's a trap down there.
Oh, a government trap?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. When you talk about someone trapping, I thought when you mentioned that, I pictured that someone wanted to catch that pig to bring it to eat it or move it somewhere or whatever. I got you. So that was like a removal plan.
Yeah.
Because it's clean now.
Yep.
Yeah. You mentioned to me some work that's been done on the disease vector issue.
Sure.
And how it might apply to people.
All right.
Can you sketch out some of the, because it's a thing people say, right? Oh, pigs are full of diseases.
Sure.
Like what?
Trichinosis. You mentioned you got a dose of that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have trichinosis. They have pseudorabies. People can't get pseudorabies, but your dog can get pseudorabies, and you hear about that happening a lot. Brucellosis. People can get brucellosis.
And cattle can get brucellosis.
Cattle can get brucellosis.
Can brucellosis move from a pig to a cow, do you know?
I think there's brucellosis, suis and brucellosis for the bovines, and I'm not sure the veterinarian guys explain it to me, and I don't follow it so much, but I know that I don't know if the suis, maybe the suis can go to the cows, but it can't be passed on or something
But it could definitely go to the domestic pigs.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the ones they would like to not get into the into the food system.
Right, and so those guys are all, the ag industry's always testing their herds, right? And they're always clean, 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 clean. And if they get a positive, that whole thing gets quarantined.
Yeah.
And transport, you know, stops, whether it's in-state, out-of-state, whatever the regs are, you know, transport stops. So
yeah, so for listeners, if you follow how every year – you'll hear a big story about people fighting over whether bison that are leaving Yellowstone National Park. The issue there comes down to this thing we're talking about with brucellosis. Depending on who you ask, I'll actually lay this whole thing out real quick as much as I can. So when the snows pile up in the late winter, you'll have buffalo migrate out of Yellowstone National Park. And they'll come out into various private lands, national forest lands, and go about their business. There's a fear that these animals will reintroduce a Eurasian cattle disease back to cattle. So cattle that were brought here to the U.S. had a disease called brucellosis. Brucellosis was passed to buffalo, and there's infections in the park. But then in the meantime, they eradicated it from domestic cows. So now the cattle producers in Wyoming and Montana enjoy what's called brucellosis-free status. They don't need to do the constant rigorous testing because there's no cases, and they haven't had a case in a while. What they're very afraid of is the minute one of these buffalo comes out, rubs noses, or no, it's actually passed, they'll drop a fetus and animals will lick and eat each other's afterbirth. One of these things is going to pick the disease up, and all of a sudden the cattlemen of these states will no longer enjoy brucellosis-free status. And I think that it actually, this is something that should be fixed, really. It actually goes state level. So a guy in the south, you know, the guy in the extreme south of Montana or the extreme north of Wyoming could get brucellosis in his cattle herd, and it affects a guy 400 miles away up in some other corner of the state. Some people say that the brucellosis thing in terms of buffalo, some people say it's all bullshit. And what it really comes down to is a conversation about grazing rights. So that's just, and they say that this brucellosis thing is sort of a proxy in place of this other argument about, is this grass belong to cattle or does this grass belong to these wild ass animals? And so people fight that out all the time. But until sitting here with you right now, I had no idea that there's with same. Wild pigs a brucellosis
right.
issue.
Right, and so they're a reservoir, right? We can get it out of domestics, but you cannot get it out of the wild population. So it's always there. It's always a threat. It's always an issue.
Can you explain, you mentioned something yesterday that there's like a closed system with domestic pork.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, back in the day, everybody raised their hogs out in the pasture or woven wire fence, you know, hog wire, we called it, electric fence. Or
feeding them restaurants.
Right, feeding them the whole thing. And you heard as a kid, hey, cook your pork, whatever, cook it. Well, you don't hear that so much anymore because in order to meet that demand, those pigs have been brought inside and raised in confinement. It's much easier. You don't have to worry about the disease. You don't have to, you could monitor it and measure it and move your animals
and
through.
Control their diet.
Of course. Yeah. The whole thing. So when they're in there, they're not, rubbing noses or whatever with feral swine, you're not transmitting disease out there on the ground or picking up those different nematodes or whatever it is. We can get it out now. There's kind of a movement to go back to more of a free-range, pasture-fed type of pork, which is kind of a neat thing, I think. But those diseases are going to start popping back up. You're going to get trichinosis. People are going to get those different things because they're not cooking their pork.
Probably incentivizes people, especially well, to control the wild, to control the feral swine.
Sure. Yeah.
Increased chance of exposure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In the U.S. Right now, I can't remember what 90 some percent of trichinosis cases are transmitted through black bear meat.
Yeah. Yeah.
No way to get it out of black bears.
No. So that's that. Those disease issues are a reason that we often get the question, why don't you guys donate the meat? There's a number of reasons we don't donate the meat of the hogs that we capture. Number one is a disease issue. We work for the federal government. Could you imagine if we donated
a bunch of trichinosis laden meat?
Sure, to somebody and they're eat up with trichinosis. I mean, that's a nightmare. Plus, you don't want to be giving people trichinosis. Gee whiz.
Mm-hmm. What are the handling risks?
Each state, Game and Fish puts out a handling risk. Wear gloves. If you have cuts on your hands and, wear gloves, don't clean it. Wash your hands good afterwards. Cook your pork thorough. If it's a wild hog, cooking will kill most all that stuff, but 100% of the people are not going to 100% cook their pork. Another reason we don't like to donate them, so to speak, is it gives them value. And once someone starts receiving free pork, what's the incentive to get rid of that pork or want it gone,
No, I could see that it would create earlier we talked about mission confusion.
Yeah.
It would create mission confusion for sure.
Yeah.
So do you feel that? I know this is going on all around the country, but do you feel that it's plausible that in 10 years we'd be like, wow, turns out, Missouri, for instance, no longer has wild pigs?
Yeah, so in 10 years, I don't know if we'll have wild pigs or not, but I will say it's relatively new and is, 10, 15 years. So the populations are not as dense as they are in other parts of the country. Once again, the Missouri Department of Conservation rolled up their sleeves and said, we're going to fix this. And they've put the resources into fixing that. And I believe our population, even within this short infancy of the program, is starting to shrink. So what's going to happen in 10 years, I can't tell you. But I know that we're doing good in the areas that we're working. They're getting harder to find. We're getting more opposition from the people who want them, which is, in my mind, a good thing, because they're going, it's harder for them to hunt them. They're not able to do what they have and move them and transport them and all those things they've done for, untouched for the last 10 years. So, I think in 10 years, our six elimination areas are going to, or maybe four elimination areas.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much is all this costing everybody? I mean, like, these decisions by people to take these, decisions by people to break the law and cut loose feral swine, right, winds up being sort of an enormous burden on people.
So the starter money was from the APHIS Feral Swine Initiative, and it was to the tune of $20 million. And so that has been, like I said, seed money or starter money. Each state runs a little bit different program depending on how the state wants it handled or what they do. But so starter money was $20 million. Now, people have developed cooperative relationships like we have in Missouri. The Mark Twain National Forest puts in a lot of money. Missouri State Parks, like I said, the Missouri Department of Conservation, Army Corps of Engineers, they're all throwing money into a pot for USDA, APHIS Wildlife Services, to hire trappers and do that work. So, all across the state, just governmental agencies, there's no telling, it's the multi millions of dollars, not to mention the private people who are doing those types of things, so.
I remember years ago looking at a map of the U.S. and it showed where you could raise cattle without supplemental feeding. And it was surprising, like the places you can't raise cattle without supplemental feeding. Have you ever seen a map? Has anyone drawn up a map of where is it possible that wild pigs could get established when you factor in climate issues? I have a hard time picturing that northern Wyoming
wouldn't faze them.
The brutality of
the winter. They're in Quebec. They're all in Canada. It doesn't faze them. They're tough as nails. That's why they're such a bad invasive. Yeah. Wouldn't faze them.
Because I've seen pictures of them in Siberia.
Sure.
In the running around in the snow, which sure looks crazy.
Yeah.
But you feel like northern Wyoming's harsher climate, huh?
I remember that Colorado feels it's plausible.
I think they've already had them in there.
Yeah, but there's a difference, and maybe you can speak to this. Maybe Parker can speak to this. There's a difference, like the Michigan ones. The Michigan cases wind up being these like isolated cases where some guy's running some little fake hunting place where you go and pretend that you're hunting a pig, right? And he gets some escape, like a dozen get away. So all of a sudden, oh my God, Michigan's got wild pigs. But it's kind of like very isolated, gets mopped up pretty quickly. It's not sort of this where you just have these populations that are naturally reproducing, going on for many generations, spreading around. You just get these like isolated blips. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm not like a pig guy, a wild pig guy. I've enjoyed hunting them in quite a number of locations. But, yeah, it's hard for me to picture that in Wyoming, it's open country, tons of snow, extremely cold. It's just hard for me to picture that that it's possible that a sounder would get a foothold and start naturally reproducing and not just be wiped out.
Was the question? Can you wipe them out, or could they live there?
You're right. I asked two different things.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so the northern Wyoming, I've never been there. I'm guessing it's open. A lot of rolling prairie. I don't know. Aerial gunning would be extremely, extremely effective.
Okay.
And yeah, it would be.
So easy to eliminate. But,
sure.
But
could live there perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As evidenced by the fact, like I said, they come from Siberia.
Right. You know, I know they, my counterpart in North Dakota, they do feral swine work coming in from Canada all
North
the time.
North Dakota?
Yeah.
Oh, it's coming from the north.
Yeah. What? The influx is from the north.
North Dakota gets feral pigs coming
from
Canada.
The north. Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Sure. Yeah.
What are they doing up there?
Somebody put them there.
No, but what are they eating?
They're pigs. They'll eat anything, you know. Roots, tubers, eggs, you know, whatever.
So there's wild pigs crossing
vegetation.
The international border.
Sure, yeah.
Huh. All right, that answers that question.
Regularly.
So that's how we're going to get them in Montana, too, right next door. So you keep tabs on kind of what's going on in the whole country.
Well, no, I don't care. I know what's going on, you know, just by my counterparts and the projects right. they're doing. You
yeah.
know.
So in the States, I only know one for sure, I think off the top of my head, but like Indiana has mm-hmm. outlawed the hunting of the pigs. Do they feel over there like that's working for them?
They do. And states that outlaw hunting have recognized that hunting is, and I wish there was a different word than hunting. I don't even like to say hunting, but it's pursuit of barnyard animals. I don't know.
I'm with you.
Yeah, so they've recognized that is what exacerbates the problem. That's why they're there. That's why people move them. That's what they want to do. Now, those states that don't have that culture, they can go, we've banned wild hog hunting. Everybody goes, all right, whatever. We don't know what you're talking about. You know, so it's a very effective yeah. way to get some really important legislation introduced.
Everyone I know that used to move fish around from lake to lake and river to river, if you told them it was illegal to fish that species of fish in that lake, even though it didn't have any yet, they would have been completely de-incentivized.
Of course.
To dump them in there.
Why would you do it? Sure.
Unless someone's like, I'm just a rule breaker anyway, man, and a rule breaker, I'll break the rule of putting them there, and then I'll break the rule of hunting them.
Yep, goes back to the public land thing. If you got a bucket full of whatever fish, and that guy's like, don't ever come to my pond, and this neighbor over here says, everybody can fish, you're right in the pond, man.
Yeah.
You know? Same thing.
Where are you going to go next?
Where am I going to go next?
Yeah.
I'm going home to finish my turkey season.
No, but I mean, what's your next, like, what, like, in a career like yours, what happens next? You did New Hampshire,
yeah.
Florida,
yeah.
Missouri?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm digging Missouri. I'm pretty mad at the pigs right now, so we'll stick it out here a while and see what happens.
And how many guys do you have out right now? Not right now, but I mean, how many guys are working the pig problem?
So, like, we go back to the partnership. It's being looked at nationally as a good model on how to eliminate feral swine and those different agencies. About half of them actively have people out on the ground doing hog trapping, and we work together seamlessly. MDC, Missouri Department of Conservation, USDA, Fish Wildlife Service, Mark Twain National Forest, Army Corps of Engineers, all those trappers know each other. They're all in communication. They're working around them. So I have 20, 25 or so going, and MDC has however many they have in Mark Twain. So, you know, as far as people doing actual trapping in the state, there's quite a few.
So yeah. You have 25 trappers.
Right.
Now, what's a good year for those guys? The higher the numbers would be the worse the year, but let me phrase it different.
So you got one guy. You got one guy. If they kill three pigs, they're high-fiving and going to get beers because, hey, they killed three pigs out of 10 to 30% of the population. The other guy across the state killed 600 and he has no idea, you know. He's just working as hard as he can. So
I see.
Yeah, it depends on where you are, man. You know, hey, there's legendary pigs. Hey, we finally got her. We finally did, and the word spreads. You know,
Like some female. That just,
right, like, yes.
Like, how long had she been a legend? Like, how long has she been invading?
A couple of years. Wow. You'd kill her offspring, and she'd still be knocking around, you know. And
can't shoot her, can't trap her.
Yeah, yeah, super, super smart. And then finally you get her, you know, and it's, yeah. And once you get them, you know, you got them. And that's why it's so important not to just remove a few because of the fecundity of hogs. Man, you got to get them all, and you got to be relentless, and you got to stay on them. And, you know, 90% of our effort goes into 5% of the population. It's that last 5%.
I see.
That's the same thing. Remember when Steve Kendrot was talking about getting rid of those nutria?
Yeah, same thing.
He's like, man, it was easy to get the first 95%, but man, that last 5%, man, they had to come up with all kinds of different techniques.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. People are talking about off the wall stuff, and you're going, try it. Try it. Yeah. Yeah. We got to get her.
What's like one of the most off the wall strategies you can think of that someone used to get a pig?
There's been all sort of bait, lure, attractant concoctions made up. They're generally killed by night shooting.
Those last holdouts.
And generally it's the guys that make the decision, I'm going nocturnal. And I'm not going to see the light of day until I do. And they stay up all night, and they just become the night predators, you know.
Yeah.
And those guys are it becomes personal with them, you know. It's like, I've been after this animal for, you know, and wanting to do a good job. And some of our people are so super dedicated. And generally that's what gets them, the nocturnal, you know, guys.
Being able to scratch an area off the map.
Scratch it off the map. There's something to be said for that. You know, hey, that dot's gone now, or that blob's gone, and the blobs are shrinking, and we're doing stuff statewide, and the feedback you get from the landowners, man, it's just it's awesome to be able to help them with that problem.
Yeah. Can I ask you something that has nothing to do with pigs?
Yeah.
You were saying that you grew up I'm going to segue into it, because you grew up with pig dogs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. But
that's not an effective tool to even use in these situations.
I say this, hog dogs are the most efficient way to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go catch one pig. Okay. Now, if you show me a pig dog that can catch 62 at once, by God, I'm singing the song of the hog dogs, but no.
But even when you got it down to that one, if you were looking at it, like, that's not really the way to go about it.
In Missouri, that's something that we've decided not to do. In other areas, they do utilize that tool, and it can be effective.
Okay.
Yep.
When you got one, you can't.
When you're down to the last one, right?
You can use it. So, but you also said you grew up with squirrel dogs.
Yeah.
And then you imported squirrel dog technology.
I did.
Into a place that isn't using it.
Right. And it is,
Did you bring your squirrel dogs to New Hampshire?
No,
that would have caught them by surprise.
I did not.
There.
They have those, you probably know about it, red squirrels, man. Like, yeah. Those things are no good. No, they're red squirrels.
I know those well.
And you,
pine squirrels.
Yeah, pine squirrels. You wouldn't want to taint a good southern squirrel dog on a red squirrel. So we stayed away from that.
You know, you can eat them. People say they, you know, it tastes like turpentine or whatnot because they eat a lot of pine.
Yeah.
It's basically a squirrel that just happens to be very small.
Yeah.
It's just a small squirrel.
But
there are guys in Alaska that will go out in the winter and hunt pine squirrels to eat. Pine squirrels have at times had fur market value. Oh. So there's been times when, for paintbrush and other usages, when you could get like a buck for a pine squirrel. And there'd be guys, you know, in the old days, not the old days, but,
yeah,
you know, during the, you know, periods during the 1900s, when they're worth a buck a piece, and people would go stack up hundreds of them.
That's good money.
And make money on buck a piece pine squirrels.
Yeah.
But food wise, even where I grew up, if you were out hunting squirrels, we hunted gray squirrels and fox squirrels, when you saw a pine squirrel, you wouldn't go after it. But they'd be intermixed, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know the dog would differentiate between those.
I don't know how they'd respond to it.
I don't know either.
But, you know, the pine squirrels are feisty.
Yeah.
Like they prey on snowshoe hare leverets.
Oh.
Yeah. They did a mortality study on snowshoe hares. And I think they found that of the 20, like they, of the ones they lost, they found 27 of them. Or some, sorry. They did this mortality study, and of the ones they were able to put tracking devices on, 27% of them turned up in snow in squirrel middens, pine squirrel middens.
Really?
They hammer them.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Bird eggs, snowshoe hare babies, all kinds of stuff. They're a,
yeah.
They're kind of like a, I think of them as a cross almost between like a mink and a squirrel.
Yeah.
Like in their sort of ferocity.
And the beeping, chirping, they do. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll come get right in your face.
Yeah,
man.
They do. Yeah.
They'll come right down and get in your face and get in your house.
Yeah.
There's a whole, yeah, different temperament, man.
Yeah.
They're kind of like electric with energy, you know.
Not as majestic as a gray squirrel.
No, not as majestic. But tell me about bringing squirrels. So you in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Everybody has a squirrel dog, you're saying?
Yeah, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, you know, East Tennessee. There's a lot, you know, a lot more squirrel hunting with dogs that goes on there. I think squirrel hunting's probably pretty common all up and down the East Coast, you know, where the gray squirrels are.
Yeah,
and
but not with dogs.
Not with dogs so much.
But when you bring squirrel dogs.
Yeah.
So
you make a lot of friends, man, when you bring squirrel dogs in Missouri.
Because people want to go hunt with you.
Oh, yeah, it's great fun.
But are the squirrels not used to it? Like, did you find a difference? Like, man, these squirrels are just not expecting this.
No.
So the squirrels are responding to the dogs the same here than they do where they've had many, many years of exposure to dogs.
Yeah. I don't know that they know it's a dog or a fox or a coyote. They just know that it's something that could eat them and they want to get away from it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like the land of milk and honey when you first showed up with your dogs.
Well, it's the land and milk of milk and honey in as much as there's a lot more fox squirrels in Missouri than in Alabama or Georgia.
You guys are mostly hunting eastern grays down there.
Mostly, yeah. Some of those big southern fox squirrels, we call them cat squirrels, you know, those great big ones, you know, all varied colors. Well, the fox squirrels here are mostly red. And they seem to be, I don't know if they're not as intelligent as the gray squirrels. And they sit out where the dogs can see them, man, and they hang their tail down like a flag and it. And
so it makes it easier to pick them
out.
It
drives
the
dogs nuts. Yeah. Yeah. They can see them. So,
man, I've never thought. Have you ever thought that? Like a sort of
less
caginess difference between grays and fox squirrels?
I was delicate on that. There's a difference. There's a distinct difference
of caginess.
Of caginess.
Now, I know that like the micro habitats they like are different.
Correct.
For sure.
Yeah.
And there's areas I've hunted where it's all one. There's areas I've hunted where it's all the other. But where I grew up, there was intermixed. And it might be that down in the ravine bottom or whatever, you get down there and it'd be a lot of grays down in there. And then up top, you know, up in the beech trees up top, you'd see a lot of fox squirrels. But you wouldn't think anything of looking up the tree and seeing one of each.
Yeah.
And I've never detected like that one was. I used to think, we like the fox squirrels better because they're huge.
Yeah.
And the gray squirrels, at times, we like them better because they're more of a novelty. But over my life, gray squirrels became far more prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what that's attributed to. Just watch that shift happen to become, in that area where I grew up, to become like not nearly the fox squirrels as we had gray squirrels.
Right.
And I don't think it's just because people were selective pressure from hunting.
Oh, no.
I
don't think it's very, very negligible on squirrel populations, if any.
But up here, you're hunting where people aren't hitting them hard, though, right?
Yeah. I hunt and have never seen another squirrel hunter in there. I don't know that. I think parts of the state, people hunt them a little bit, but where I am in central Missouri, I've never seen another squirrel hunter, let alone a dog squirrel hunter. Now,
you hunt public land?
I hunt public land, both public and private, yeah.
What's a good day?
A good day, I think our best day this year was maybe 18 or so.
How do you guys cook them?
Well, I killed 211 this year, and so I've cooked them every way I can. My wife is had it with me and squirrel meat.
She's sick of it.
She's done. And, you know, my children, Grace and Brody, they got the 20 gauges and they follow me around and do a great job. But like I told you guys, I've eaten a lot of lead shot this year. A lot.
So you're waiting for the kids to get old enough to be able to use 22s.
Yeah, I am. And when your wife bites down into the number six, it's not counting when you do. You bite down, spit it out, and go, oh, shot. You know, she looks at you with it.
Out, like, yeah. You got to kiss the cook.
That's right.
She finds a piece of shot.
Yeah. Mama gives you the evil look. So,
well, yeah, but on lead, it's not bad. It's like, you know, I know half people I know have lost teeth, busted teeth on steel shot.
Yeah.
Lead, you know, I mean, sure. You don't want to be eating it, but it's not as horrible for your teeth as it is eating waterfowl.
Right.
But what are you guys fry it?
Yeah, we fry it.
Cook it down and pick it? What do you do?
Yeah, we cook it down and pick it. Man, you name it. Make gumbo, jambalaya. We make everything.
You ever just fry barbecue it on bone?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah.
You barbecue it?
Yeah. You have 200 squirrels in the freezer, you're coming up with different ways to cook them.
What are your kids' feelings about it?
As far as eating it?
Yeah.
I'll scarf it down. Particularly my little girl, Grace. She knocks it down. They love it. I think it's one of the most underrated meats,
dude,
in the woods.
Yeah.
It's delicious.
And there's no one who eats it when it's properly prepared.
It's delicious.
People are blown away by it.
Sure.
Have you sous vide any?
No.
Might be onto something.
Maybe so.
I'm going to send Parker honorary membership to the Rocky Mountain Squirrel Foundation.
Yeah. You're going to have to start an Eastern branch of the Rocky Mountain Squirrel Foundation.
Yeah.
Do you like the fox squirrels? Or like when you go out and hunt them, if you shoot a couple of each, are you like stoked that you got a few fox squirrels?
No, man, I want the gray squirrels. I like the gray squirrels.
For eating?
The dogs like the fox squirrels.
Mom, you think a gray squirrel eats better than a fox squirrel?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Really?
Yeah, you guys don't?
Well, no, because you can't argue.
Eating them enough to
you can't argue with the size, man.
What are I know, but the flavor and the toughness issue. Ooh. I think.
Huh.
See, that's another question for you, because what I've been starting to do is I'll try to grade them, which I think from what I think are young squirrels. If I have a pile, I mean, if I only have three, then whatever, they're all going in the same bag. But if I've got 10. I'll be like, all right, those are like the four old tough bastards with, you know, nuts as big as your thumb.
Right.
Those are going into the crock pot.
Right.
And then I'll try to be like, all right, those are look younger, and I'll cook them whole on the grill, and they can be eaten that way.
I'd almost trade you a mess of headshot young gray squirrels for almost anything else in the woods. I mean, those are the primo.
You would give other stuff to receive those.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What,
a turkey breast?
Yeah, probably a turkey breast.
Damn.
I'd trade a turkey breast for a limit of headshot grays. I'm just saying that.
Those are strong words.
Are you familiar with the chef? Are you familiar with the chef Jamie Oliver?
No.
English kid? Not kid. I don't know how old he is. Well, he's just got this marinade. Some recipe book I had of his, he's got this marinade where it's like lemon and thyme and pulped up thyme and lemon juice and olive oil and whatnot. But what I started doing is taking the squirrels and taking a fork. So skin the squirrel, right? Piece it out. And then take a fork and that back leg, I will jab that fork.
Yeah, a jillion times.
20, 30 times in that back leg. Just completely perforate. Because you once you're eating, you never know that, like, it's not like it's full of holes, right? It comes back together.
Sure.
Perforate it a bunch of times, and then take the back straps and prick them a ton of times, and then marinate them and just cook them on a grill.
It's unbeatable.
So nothing like slow cooking, just cook them on a grill and then eat the meat off.
Huh.
I've never done a fox squirrel like that, though.
You need to, and then report back.
Yeah, because once I got on to doing that recipe, I was only in gray squirrel areas.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I was doing that when I was hunting in New York State. And in New York State, a lot of eastern grays.
Yeah.
Western grays.
Are you a step on the tail and yank them off, skinning?
No,
You don't tail skin?
No, I don't.
And you're from the American South?
I am. I know a lot of guys who do.
You do the pants and shirt?
I do the pants and shirt. But I think as I get older and my strength goes, I'm going to have to tail skin. But I pants and shirt them. I can go right through them pretty good.
And you use a feist or a cur dog?
I use a cur dog. It's a smaller cur.
Just one dog?
I just have one dog. Now, I have some friends who I've introduced into it that we hunt together. So.
And they're getting dogs too?
Oh, yeah. It's total. And I was telling my friends at the Department of Conservation that there's the three squirrel dog men now. I'm sure there's others. I just don't know them, you know, in Missouri, and I'm coming for them to extend the season a little bit longer. So,
do you think you're going to grow to regret introducing that piece of technology and not just keeping quiet about it?
Of course not. And you know why?
No.
It's the kids. It's great, great kid hunt. I mean, you don't have to be quiet. You can walk around. You can teach them gun control, walking through the woods, crossing fences, safety, all of those things. It's enjoyable. They're not freezing. Their pet is there, so they get to pet their dog. I got my squirrel dog. I grew up doing it, and I got it for the children, and it is I won't regret that.
Is this a house dog or an outside dog?
Well, I'm ashamed to say it, and the people that know me are going. It gets in my wife's bed. It follows her around. Now, not my bed. We sleep in the same bed, but I don't claim it as our bed. She, I'm like, get that dog out of my bed. I've got it. You know, when I am going to get a squirrel dog, I went and picked it up from a buddy in Alabama that grows them, has some nice squirrel dogs. Had a pen built, you know, the whole thing ready, nice kennel, I thought was good, even put it up off the ground so the dog wouldn't be on the gravels, had a hay bale I was going to put, and that's not been in the pen once.
Our friend Kevin Murphy is telling me that he recently heard of a squirrel dog selling for $20,000.
That must be a good squirrel dog.
You'd like to think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I don't know that I've seen one that good.
So you just got yours?
Yeah.
When you have a squirrel dog, what's the minimum amount you can hunt it and still have it know what's up? Still have it know how to do it?
Well, it depends on the dog. You know, but, you know, the more you hunt any dog, the better it is.
For sure. But when let's say you live in a state where you can't hunt squirrels for 5 months out of the year.
You can still put them up, can't you? Just not shoot them?
Okay. The dog doesn't get tired of that?
No, it's in them. You know, it's like a retriever. If that dog laying on the floor there, if you took a tennis ball, it'd probably throw till bring it back to you till he died. He doesn't know why. He just wants to do it.
So you can train, you can run squirrels, and if you don't shoot the squirrel out of the tree, the dog doesn't get mad. He still thinks he had a good time.
Oh, he's loving it. Yeah, yeah. My dog particularly doesn't care. Some of the dogs really want to get the squirrel. My dog, you know, once the squirrel's dead, it could care less. It. The drive is to tree another squirrel.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you something graphic right now.
Okay.
Our friend Kevin Murphy, his squirrel dog, one of them.
Eats the head.
Yep.
They all.
Is that common?
That's very common. I had a dog, Jack, that only wanted, we called him head juice. They only wanted to eat the head. I don't know what that is.
That
but
just runs in squirrel dogs.
They just want to crunch their head. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I thought that dog was sick. Now I think it's just a normal dog.
Yeah, it's common.
And then, did it just come out of the box wanting to hunt squirrels, or did you have to try to teach it something?
No, they. You don't have to teach it much. Now you mess with it and show it squirrels and bring it along and but yeah, it's in them. You know, it's like a retriever or a pointer or whatever. You know, they're bred to want to be tree dogs, and so that's what they do. The hard thing for me is to differentiate between yard squirrels and woods squirrels. So. You know, mama and the kids like seeing the squirrels in the yard. I got to wait for them to leave to thin those down.
Do that,
you know,
huh?
the dog's looking out, you know, looking out the window, just quivering, you know, you know, going crazy. And, you know, so, but it's fun.
And then do you keep a dog for hunting ducks too?
I don't. No, just the squirrel dog. And
you just go over and pick up ducks yourself.
Yeah. If I'm lucky enough to hit one, yeah.
Do you view because you grew up hunting and grew up around that, Do you view your work now as like an extension of that, or does it just feel like completely different? It's like, it's just, there's work and then there's what you do for fun.
It's completely different, but the reason I have this job is because of my love for the outdoors and hunting and fishing. And so what I do now, the enjoyment I get is seeing that my work is going to the benefit of the outdoors, or
benefit of native wildlife,
sure, and, the ecosystems and those, So this is just an extension of liking to do that.
Do good trappers, when you have a trapper working for you, do all the good trappers have a hunting and fishing background, or can you just, or do you find people can just get it and figure it out even though they didn't grow up doing that kind of stuff?
Both. Yeah. There's no, a lot of times the guys who grew up and gals grew up doing it are a little bit more familiar with it, but you know, we've had some people with no background whatsoever, and we introduced them and trained them, and it turned out really top notch.
Yeah,
sure.
And then you mentioned that, so you found that you have men and women that work on the trapping teams,
right?
Yeah. And then do the people that trap, do they wind up staying with it for years, or is it like summer technician kind of jobs?
Both. It's kind of like you love it, or you after you get a belly full, you kind of want to do something else. So there's people who have done it their entire career, and that's all they want to talk about, and it totally consumes them. Mm-hmm. There's people who do a good job and say, okay, you know, I've caught enough hogs or whatever, or coyotes or whatever it is, and they move on, or they move up into, you know, in a more of a biologist role, you know, and they work on different things, and you know, it's just natural progression.
Is it hard to fill the positions? The reason I'm asking all these questions is I could picture a lot of people that listen to this would be like, man, that's the job for me.
Yeah, it's not hard to fill the position at all. But it's very hard.
People want that work.
It's very hard to get people to stay. Everything turns into a job, right? And so,
so they think they're going to be out just hunting pigs all day.
Yeah, pig hunting.
Good times.
And if you hunted, and then we don't hunt them, we do control work. If you hunted pigs every day, you got up and you went to work at 8 o'clock and came home at 5 o'clock, and you hunted pigs all day long, you're going to get real tired of that real quick.
Yeah, not nearly as fun.
No.
Yeah, you got any more questions?
Yeah, I did have one just now. Shucks, can you come back to me?
Yeah. Because I'll tell you something. I started trapping muskrats with my brothers when we were young. I was 10 when I caught my first muskrat. And then I got into all manner, you know, I trapped everything, fur trapping, and stuck with it till I was 22. Mm. When I set my last, you know, when I set my last trap with the intent of making money on it. Now and then I'll go catch something for making, you know, fur hat for me or my wife or whatever. But when I found out about that there was such a thing as like animal damage control work, for a while I thought that was the job I was going for. Mm-hmm. Like I would have in some other version of events, I'd have been one of the people sending in an application to check pigs, trap pigs. It would have been like immensely appealing to me.
I had a sit down interview once with the guy. It was a private guy working in Colorado, and we started just chatting. I was working in retail. He's like, you know, we ought to, you know, have pizza or something. There's a pizza joint right next door. So I met him for lunch a few days later, and I was jacked up. I was like, yeah, dude, this sounds great. You know, I'll learn all about this. And he's like, yeah, it's, you know, most of it's during like September, October, November. And I was like, hold on, that's hunting season. I can't be doing that. You know,
what was he after?
It was probably mostly a lot of beaver work, you know, beavers messing up, you know, chopping down people's pretty aspens in their backyards along all the creeks in Colorado, a lot of that, probably some coons.
What kind of retail were you doing?
Selling retail clothes, outdoor clothing shop.
Oh, yeah.
But remember my question, coyotes are kind of a new animal here in Missouri, right?
No, they've been around for quite a while.
Like more than a couple decades?
They're new tons of other places. I didn't know that. So they've had a foothold here for a long time?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they've been here for quite a while. Yeah.
So people that were kids here in the 60s, 70s, they had coyotes?
Yeah. Yeah. They've been here a long time, as long as I can remember.
Interesting. Yeah. Kind of figure this is part of the west, the eastern migration. But I can still follow that up with, do you have many conflicts with coyotes that you guys deal with?
We do have some conflicts, not as many as some of the western states, the sheep growers and some of the cattle places. A lot of ours are urban conflicts.
A couple get cats getting nabbed.
Seeing them running around and you know, coyotes can live anywhere and they do pretty good anywhere they are. So yeah, most of ours would probably be urban. You know, they like to, for wildlife services anyway, they like that the airport environment. So we take some off of airports and those types of things, but not as big of an issue in Missouri as it is in other states. The Missouri Department of Conservation does some coyote work. It's not really our arena.
Got it.
Yeah.
Brandon, you must have been hanging out, but do you have any concluders? Any final things you wanted to ask about?
Nothing to ask about. I think just as a concluder, I wanted to just kind of emphasize how complicated conservation is. And people always attribute hunting to conservation, but I think in the case of the feral hog, that's the opposite. And I'd encourage people, especially here in Missouri, to not embrace that culture because it puts in jeopardy the cultures that we truly should embrace, like deer hunting and turkey hunting and squirrel hunting, our native species that belong here on the landscape. And these hogs don't. And if you participate in that, you're abiding by something that is, you know, having a negative reaction on those heritages that we hold so dear.
Yeah. You're throwing away or jeopardizing like some deep traditions.
Yeah.
And a functioning landscape.
Yeah, it's hard to manage these forests. You know, we don't just let the forest go anymore. There's a lot of work that goes into keeping these habitats healthy, and when these hogs come in and, you know, root up spring creeks and destroy species like the dragonfly you were talking about, Parker, and ruin habitat for other game species that we, you know, have such immense value on, not only recreationally in this area, but economically, it's a bad thing all the way around.
I wish it was possible to get a better sense of what kind of dent they put into turkeys, you know, as a ground nesting bird.
You know, we hear people.
It'd be so hard to look at that, probably.
Making the claim that, you know, that they eat a lot of the eggs. But I don't know if Parker's have been a study done on that you're aware of.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, there's probably several studies. But it's, let's face it, it's a hog. It's an invasive species that doesn't belong here. So if it eats one turkey nest, it's too many. Sure, they're a negative impact on all of our ground nesting birds. I mean, they root on the ground. They, you know, they take those. Not only you know, you think about it. Not only turkeys or quail, for instance, or some of those other small, you know, birds that nest low in the lands, you know, in the forest understory. You know, hogs are having an impact on those as well. So, like I said, it's an exotic invasive. So one's too many. Doesn't belong here. It's not from here, you know.
Yeah. What's funny is that the people that are trying to bring pigs in and promote pigs as a hunting thing usually sell it as how they're helping with the pig problem.
Right. And
you see it all the time, man. You can go online and they'll be like, you know, places advertising, Texas is overrun with hogs.
Come down.
Then you realize it's a fenced operation and they're actually buying pigs.
Right. Yeah.
But people like that narrative.
Sure.
I got a bunch of theories on it. A thing I found is that, and this is my concluding thought, a thing I've found with people, the people who become curious about hunting, not people who grew up in hunting culture and hunting communities, but people who didn't grow up around it, and they become curious about hunting, and they want to find a way to know it's okay. Like, they desperately want to go, but they need to be told it's okay. Those people are drawn to pig hunting.
That's right.
because they feel like, oh, you mean I can do this and know absolutely certain that I'm doing the right thing? Because they're not already educated on the fact that by participating in licensed hunting, you're contributing immense amounts of resource into wildlife habitat management, enforcement, you know, disease control. They don't get that already. They need to know that, like, that they're going to go, like, by taking a life, they're helping everyone out.
Right.
And so again and again, when I've spoken with people who are like, man, I kind of want to go hunting, think about doing hog hunting, because I understand how they're like a non-native. You just hear it all the time, man.
Yeah.
It's really gotten out there in my lifetime as this, like, as a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the first time I ever stepped foot, the first time I ever hunted in a place that had the possibility of having a pig, we were hunting deer, but I sat up in my tree stand the whole time praying a pig came by.
Sure. Sure.
I was way more interested in that than I was in a deer. I was like, my God, a pig running around in the woods.
Yeah.
How wonderful that would be. Having no idea about the bigger picture.
Right.
Issue.
Right. And, you know, we're helping, but, you know, it's I go back to the TV deal, and, you know, they passed up three sows and 14 little shoats to shoot one mature boar, which does absolutely nothing as far as population control goes. You know, it's farce, you know, in some instances, I think.
I have a friend whose family runs cattle in Northern California. And one day I was asking her father, who lets me hunt wild pigs out there, and he complains about them. But one day I was asking her father, I said, if you could wave a magic wand and have them all be gone, would you wave it? He thought about it for a minute, and he's like, no, not all of them.
That's right.
He wants it his way. He wants just not quite so many.
Yeah.
Yeah. But not all of them.
Right. Right.
So as much as he curses them and shows you where they're all hanging out and shows you what they did bad here and what they did bad there, there's some part of them that just, you know.
Well, sure. I think for a lot of people, it just comes down for like a natural empathy to animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just can't look at it and be like, oh, yeah, even though I know all this about how bad they are, wipe them out. It'd be great if they weren't on this continent anymore.
Yeah, there's maybe something, maybe there's some little nugget of goodness, residual, like some kind of nugget of goodness in people that just, a thing we've learned mm-hmm. is that wiping things out isn't general, like, and it's true, generally speaking, not a good idea, you know, yeah. And I think people carry that in and they don't, and they're not interested in the nuance of it, but it was funny to watch him wrestle with it for a minute,
mm.
You know, he's like, you can't be greedy.
Yeah.
But in Missouri, the goal is clear.
It is. It is.
Gone. And then what's the most likely source? Let's say no one brought one in. That's my last question. No one's trucking them in. They're still walking from somewhere.
Right.
From where?
We have them in Oklahoma.
Okay,
so they can. We have them in Arkansas.
They can walk in from Arkansas.
We have them in Tennessee. Illinois done a good job. So, our southern brethren.
Before I was born, my old man was hunting wild pigs in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Mine too.
So it's never going to be that it's just not a problem. It's just going to be something that requires constant monitoring.
Right. And, you know, in some states, they're a game animal, and they've embraced that. So, you know, it varies all over
California,
the country.
California, man. You got to buy a tag.
Right. That's right. That's right. So
there's no limit on how many tags you buy, but you got to buy a tag.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any limit on it.
Chances are they're not ever going to be all the way gone from California.
But, you know, man, I'll tell you what, people there love them.
Yeah.
Hunters. And it's kind of like it's been going on a long time.
Mm.
People have been hunting pigs there a long time.
Yeah.
There's people that that's kind of their main thing they hunt. And some of the funnest pig hunting, I hate to say this to you, but some of the funnest pig hunting I've done has been in California because you can spot and stalk wild pigs.
Sure. Yeah.
You glass them up.
It's fun.
Crawl up on them.
Yeah, there's no arguing that.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for joining us. Good
we
luck.
Give Steve Jones is here the whole time. We never even introduced
him. I didn't give him a concluder because he hadn't said anything.
I know, well, because we never introduced him. But I think
Wild Game Chef Steve Jones has been joining us, listening in.
Well, I had.
Can you start out by plugging? You post materials about Wild Game.
Yeah, I've got a
website. Tell people where that is.
KillerNoms.com. It's just kind of a small little hobby website. It's nothing monetized or professional, but I just started kind of recording the things that I was learning about cooking wild game, and I just enjoy.
I checked it out. It's good. I'll vouch for it. There's some good information on there.
KillerNoms.com.
Excellent check cook.
Thank you very much.
Your food.
Well, I got an opportunity to come and sing karaoke for Pavarotti here, so I couldn't pass that up.
So, did you have a thought or question for our guest?
Yeah, I don't know as much about the hog problem as Parker and Brandon, but I have been reading about it and I write about it. I'm an outdoor writer also, and I would say even though I've enjoyed a few hog hunts, I've had some of my actually best hunts I've had in my life have been hog hunts. But there is no doubt in my mind that this is absolutely the only correct way to deal with a serious conservation problem. If you approach it from a conservation or land ethic perspective, there is no other choice but eradication. And,
so you're able to look at it and hold both ideas in your head at once.
Absolutely.
It's nice to hunt them.
Just
nice to eat them, but they got to go.
Absolutely. They got to go. Go hunt them where they're natural. You know, where they're not an introduced exotic. But if I could change one thing, because I talk to a lot of hunters, the everything that the USDA APHIS is doing is great. Everything that the Missouri Department of Conservation is doing is great, except they haven't sold or explained the idea about why they have banned hog hunting on their own MDC lands, Missouri Department of Conservation. And that people that aren't fully coached up on all the details, it is counterintuitive. They do not get it.
Yeah.
Brandon and I talked to a pilot a couple of weeks ago who was coming in for a landing. There were a couple of feral hogs on the runway, and he was railing at us about why would the Department of Conservation say you can't shoot the pigs? You know, it's just counterintuitive. Even
for
though
sure,
it's the
man.
Right thing, yeah. I just wish they were doing a better job of explaining and selling it to the public. Because
well, you know, they've had several of these podcasts and webcasts and call-in type of things, and I think getting the word out, I disagree with you in as much as they're trying, but to get everybody educated, you know, people have to educate themselves to some extent, you know, and you're right, it is counterintuitive, and it's a difficult thing to sell, but... You know, I think the program's in its infancy. If you think about it, you know, we've been trying to eliminate feral swine for really 3 years. You know, hardcore. And I think as time goes on, I think the word will get out. Everything takes time, and that messaging. And you guys know this probably more than I do. That messaging, you just hammer it over and over, and finally it takes hold. You know, it's like putting your seatbelt on. Kind of thing. Put your seatbelt on to your kids. Put your seatbelt on. Put your seatbelt. Finally, they're putting their seatbelt on, and you didn't tell them. They're telling you, hey, put your seatbelt on. Hey, hogs are bad. Hogs are bad. Hogs are bad.
And I think probably it would eventually lead to a certain amount of kind of like public shaming. Like the more it gets out, the more guys that are engaged in it, their bodies might be like, you know, man,
yeah,
we should probably cut it out.
Yeah.
That's working both ways, though. There was just a propaganda meeting down here led by a local state representative bringing together people, you know, talking about the arrogance of the Department of Conservation and the fact that they would ban hunting. Look at our Department of Conservation is now siding with anti-hunters. I mean, the propaganda machine is another huge roadblock to making this happen. And now, of course, everybody with social media can spread just complete half-truths and mistruths, and you know it's fighting two battles. It's fighting the ecological battle and it's fighting the social battle and trying to get people to buy in to what needs to be done to protect the resources.
Yeah. Good job, Steve.
Thank you.
You stirred up a whole bunch of. You're like a pig wild in the spring creek, man. Stirred up a whole bunch of silt and mud. All right, man. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I know it's probably taken away from your main thing you'd like to be doing.
Not too much.
Not right now. We can't turkey hunt after 1 o'clock.
That's right.
We got to get that changed.
Yeah. After 1 o'clock, and squirrel season should go on after February 15th.
For how long?
Till the day before turkey season.
Okay.
Well, that would mean it's only closed for a month, right?
Correct.
Let's just go all year squirrel season.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks.